Good evening, all. Good to see the room packed out, which is great. I'm sorry, we're starting a bit late. It's my fault. I was teaching on the other side of the campus, and normally I would run, but this evening I had to walk carefully, so sorry about that. We're here. I'm Tony Travers, by the way, from the Institute of Public Affairs, but this is an event being run largely by the European Institute and the IPA together. And what we're here to talk about is the impact of Brexit on London. Now, the word Brexit and the word London are both inherently interesting ones, to do them in reverse order. London, the school, the city in which the LSE is located, but also one of the world's most interesting, studied, and in its way sort of globally focused places. Brexit, whose origins have been interpreted as including, at some level, something of a rejection of some of this internationalism, global focus, and so on. And if you look at the vote patterns in the Brexit vote back in 2016, whereas the UK voted 52-48 to leave, London voted 60-40 to remain. Only Scotland, in fact, of all of the nations and regions of the UK, voted slightly more to remain than London. And with that in mind, we thought it would be a good idea to have a debate, a discussion about this, a panel, it's not a debate, a discussion, about what some of the impacts might be of Brexit on London. We've already seen within the last couple of weeks government figures being leaked about the regional impact, or the imagined regional impact, or potential regional impact of three versions of Brexit. And suffice to say, in the best traditions of being surprised what comes out of these things, London, which voted Remain, appeared to be least affected by Brexit. And if you looked at the other end of the spectrum, some of the regions that had voted most strongly to leave would be significantly negatively affected. Now, of course, these are all projections, forecasts, they're not real numbers yet. So it's a very complex political issue which could affect London, as the rest of the UK, negatively or positively. You know, I don't want to prejudge anything this evening. But to help us come to that, to get to a decision about this, and we'll have some time for Q&A between now and when we finish at 8 o'clock, we have two speakers. We have Naomi Clayton from the Centre for Cities. Welcome, Naomi. I've worked with the Centre for Cities many, many times in the past. They are by far, I'm a bit careful there, others, but they're a preeminent think tank on the subject of cities within the United Kingdom, produce excellent reports. If ever you want to see sort of league tables and discussion about how cities are functioning, the Centre for Cities website is the place to go, and they have lots of nice events as well. Neave Maloney, Professor Neave Maloney, my colleague, here, our colleague here in the LSE, is in the Department of Law, an expert on financial and city-type matters. So what we have is here two excellent speakers who can introduce the subject. Then we'll have an opportunity for Q&A, opinions, and so on, through to the end of the evening. Naomi, you're on first.
Great, and thank you very much for the introduction, Tony. So I want to look at how London's economy is likely to be affected by Brexit, drawing on some of the work that we did in partnership with the Centre for Economic Performance here at the LSC and as part of the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth last year. The starting point is a rather obvious one. London is a global hub. It's a global city, and it acts as really a magnet for international talent. So 39% of migrants moving to the UK locate in London. London accounts for 27% of the UK's trade, around 46% of the UK's trade in services, because London is predominantly a service-based economy, and around three-quarters of the capital's trade is in services, and one in five businesses in London operate primarily in the international market. So London is a global city. And as the UK's largest city, it's the largest city in Europe as well, It's incredibly important that London prospers in a post-Brexit world. So here, this chart just looks at taxes generated by our largest cities. And you can see London here stands out as generating by far the largest taxes in the country. So London's tax revenues account for nearly 30% of total national intake. So any downturn in the capital's economy is likely to have a major impact on public spending and investment in the UK. So, to look at how London's economy is likely to be affected, I want to look at kind of two aspects here. Firstly, trade, and then move on to think about migration. So here, I want to draw on some of the work that we did with the Centre for Economic Performance, where we used their model looking at the trade effects of Brexit to look at how city economies are likely to be affected by a change in the UK's trading relationships. The model looks at the economic impacts of the UK leaving the EU relative to if the UK had stayed in the EU, using some of the most kind of comprehensive data that's available on trade flows and trade barriers. And as part of this work, we looked at two different scenarios. So soft Brexit, where the UK joins a free trade area with the EU, such as the European Free Trade Association. This is a kind of similar situation to Norway. And then hard Brexit, where the EU and UK don't immediately form a free trade area, and the default situation is to trade under World Trade Organization rules. And we can see immediately that the impacts of hard Brexit in terms of loss of GBA are likely to be greater, and that all cities are likely to be negatively affected. So this chart here just sets out the GVA impact across the UK's 63 largest cities, comparing GVA impacts under the soft Brexit scenario and hard Brexit scenario. And you can see that there's a correlation there, but we go down to around 4.5% on the y-axis in terms of hard Brexit, because whilst all cities are set to be negatively affected under both scenarios, they're also likely to be more negatively affected under a hard Brexit scenario. So how does this play out in terms of geography? On the left-hand side, you can't see particularly well on this on the projector, we've got the change in GVA under the soft Brexit scenario. And it's generally places in cities in the greater southeast and along the M4 corridor that are likely to be hit hardest. The impact doubles under a hard Brexit scenario. So compared to a loss of GVA of around 2% at the national level, London is predicted to see a loss of around 2.6%. And you can see the larger, darker bubbles on the map on the right-hand side indicate the areas that are likely to be hit hardest under this scenario. And you can see, again, it's places around London in the greater southeast and along the M4 corridor, and also Edinburgh and Aberdeen in Scotland that are likely to be hit hardest. And when we look at these impacts, predicted impacts against the sectoral kind of makeup of cities, we can see that the initial shock of Brexit is likely to be greater in places that have larger kind of knowledge-intensive business service sectors, so financial and business services, essentially. So we're here, we're comparing the GVA impacts under the soft Brexit scenario and hard Brexit scenario against the proportion of employment in these cities in the private knowledge-intensive business service sectors. And we can see that there's a correlation there. So London and other cities with large business and financial service sectors are likely to be hit particularly hard under the hard Brexit scenario because of the increase in non-tariff barriers. So that's things like regulation and the loss of financial passporting rights that means under that scenario, London and other cities like London are likely to be hit hardest, at least initially. So there's two important things to note with this model. Firstly, the model only looks at the trade effects of Brexit. We're not modelling the impacts of Brexit on things like foreign direct investment, the knock-on impacts on innovation and productivity and migration. Once you start to factor in those things, the predicted loss of in terms of economic output is set to triple at the national level. So it's important to note that this model only looks at the trade effects. And we don't take account of how places are likely to adapt to these initial shocks either. So one way of thinking about how places might adapt to these shocks is to think about how they responded to the 2008 financial crisis. In general, we know that cities with larger, higher value service economies, more highly skilled populations, and higher wage economies responded and kind of adapted better in response to the financial crisis. So you can see here, if we look at economic output across the last 20 years, we can see that there was a dip in London's economic output in 2008-09, but actually since then, it's been one of the fastest growing economies in the UK. So we might well expect that actually, because of the nature of London's economy, it might be better placed, certainly compared to some of the other areas that have been mentioned in other studies, it might well fare better in the longer term. But if we go back to kind of the initial shocks of Brexit, these may well be compounded in the capital if we start to think about the impacts on migration. So, as I mentioned at the start, London has an incredibly diverse workforce. 35% of its workforce are foreign-born, and as I said, it attracts 39% of migrants locating in the UK. Here, we're just looking at the share of jobs by country of birth. And we can see here that 14% of London's labour force are European-born migrants, compared to 6% in the rest of the UK. European workers make a far greater contribution to London's labour market compared to other parts of the UK. And businesses in the capital benefit from being able to access global talent. And London's economy is more productive and innovative because of its diverse labour market. And European workers are employed across a range of industries. Here we're just comparing the number of jobs in London that are filled by European workers across broad sectoral groups and the share of jobs in those sectors that are filled by European workers. And we can see in construction and the hospitality sectors, Over a third of workers are European born in those sectors, but they do make up a large number of workers across a range of industries. So roughly one in 10 NHS workers are from the EU. So any tighter controls on migration are likely to have a knock-on impact on London's economy. And there's signs that, you know, the UK's decision to leave the EU is starting to impact on migration flows into London and the UK as a whole. So in the year following the referendum result, London has seen an 11% fall in the number of EU migrants registering in the capital. And this is likely to create skills gaps across a number of industries, which will have knock-on impacts on London's economy and the productivity of London's businesses. And of course, firms might also choose to relocate part of their activities or their businesses in response. What I should just say is that everywhere is likely to be impacted by Brexit, as the earlier slides showed, but the impacts in London are also likely to have knock-on impacts for other parts of the UK too. So we know in cities like York, one in five people working in the private sector are working for businesses that are headquartered in London. And we also know that, in general, there's quite a large flow of migration into the capital, particularly among young graduates. So this map here looks at the net flow in graduates to London, and we can see that pretty much every city, bar a couple of exceptions, sends more graduates to London than London sends back. And of all the graduates that moved city after university, 22% of them moved to London. So if we do see a fall in international migration to the capital, the response might well be that we see greater internal migration into the capital, which may well lead to further skills gaps elsewhere in the country. So it's important not to just think of London as an island. There are a number of economic interdependencies between London and other parts of the UK. So what do we do to limit the impacts of Brexit on London's economy and the UK's economy? Well, I think further work is needed to understand the potential impacts in terms of the impacts on foreign direct investment and migration, and also in terms of some of the longer run impacts as the economy adjusts. I think it's also important that we find ways to monitor the impacts of Brexit as they play out and improve our economic intelligence, particularly at the local level. At the moment, it's hard to even measure some of the kind of headline economic indicators like unemployment in a very timely way. I think government should be doing all it can to minimise the potential economic shocks by securing the best trade deal, an obvious point, but by securing the best possible trade deal with the EU, partly because the EU is the UK and London's main trading partner. There's been some debate about whether we should introduce regional immigration systems, and I think there are a number of kind of technical and operational kind of difficulties in terms of actually doing that. And I think the preferable option would be to create a migration system that works for all parts of the UK, including London. And then in terms of the government's domestic policy, the flagship domestic policy, the industrial strategy. We need to make sure that that and the local industrial strategies that are being developed as part of that give cities in particular and London the investment powers and responsibilities that they need to be able to respond to the impacts that Brexit's likely to bring and respond to their kind of unique opportunities and challenges going forward. So on that point, Ron.
Thank you, Ron.
That's fantastic, and I have to. I'm a lawyer, okay. So that's the first piece of bad news, and the second piece of bad news is that it's financial services, and this kind of stuff does not translate well into whizzy slides. So I'm going to talk. So you've had a fabulous presentation from Naomi, and I'm going to talk about financial regulation and the city. But I think Naomi beautifully brought out, really vividly, how important this sort of high value. What was the phrase? The high education, high kind of intensity, high knowledge. Yeah, how critical these industries are for London. So, so my remarks are around Brexit and the financial services space. And if you're following the news or you're reading the Financial Times generally, you're going to see constant phrases coming out, right? So you're hearing mutual recognition. You're hearing passporting. You're probably hearing equivalence. Naomi mentioned the passport. And as of a week or so ago, you're probably hearing ambitious managed divergence. Now, this language to someone like me really matters, okay? It means something. But I think all this language that's out in the world and in the zeitgeist is telling us a story, actually, about financial services and how critical they have become in the Brexit debate. Because all that language is essentially about how to figure out a way for the city to retain something close to its current levels of access. So lots of acronyms, lots of technology, but it actually comes down to kind of protecting the city's current position. So that's the kind of thing I'm going to be talking to this evening. Now, there are three important context issues right at the very start. So the first one Naomi has very vividly brought out, how important this sector is. Okay, so we've seen some of the numbers already. Just another one, financial services accounts for in and around sort of 7% of UK GDP. And the size of the city matters. Okay, so let's suppose it shrunk and became sort of still quite efficient. Size matters here, because the bigger you are as a financial market, the more likely you are to attract business. So any finance people in the audience know liquidity is really important. The more liquidity you have, the more you're going to attract. So the efficiency of the city in dealing with our pensions, our insurance policies, our risks as households, individuals and as a nation depends on the ability of the city to operate as efficiently as it can. So it's a hugely important sector. Now the second context point is the EU. So the EU does matter here. It's not one of those sectors where the relationship is a little bit more peripheral or it's a little bit less important. Because the EU27 market, all that interaction and trading and risk management and lending, all of that that's coming out of the UK into the EU, that represents about 30% of the EU's financial activity. So a huge amount of financial activity in the EU28 is currently based in the UK. Now, if you think about it, that sort of offshoring, so moving this massive funding and risk management capacity out of the EU offshore in the UK, you know, is going to have consequences. Now, from the UK's perspective, numbers vary, but in and around 25% of what the city does, broadly, is connected with the EU market. So there is this very, very close pipeline, kind of interconnection between the city and the EU marketplace. Now, third question is, well, that's fine, so it's important, it matters. It matters to the EU and the UK, okay. Well, that brings us hopefully to a nice place. If it matters to both big trading blocks, well, we'll get a deal. It should be straightforward. Now, here's where the real challenge comes in. Because financial services is probably the most highly regulated sector of the modern economy globally. And we know why, given the financial crisis. You know, we're still living, we're still going through the after effects of the financial crisis. But one of the sort of tangible effects of it has been an immense increase in financial regulation everywhere, globally. And secondly, with that, a kind of a mythic sense it can never happen again. Financial stability, above all, has to be secured. So globally, pretty much every economy in the world, if you want to access its financial markets, you will be going through hoops. There will be processes, there will be repeat regulation, there will be reauthorizations, but it is not straightforward to access another market internationally. I mean, just very recently, there were very long and very complicated negotiations between the US and the EU, two very big trading blocks on derivatives. Now, we got there in the end, but it wasn't straightforward, even though both parties had a strong interest in getting to a deal. Now, how does this kind of bring us back into kind of the Brexit discussion? Well, it's because of what we currently have. So having said that access is really complicated and costly and a big transaction cost for firms, if you're in the EU 28 bloc, it isn't. Because the EU 28 bloc has, Naomi mentioned it earlier, has a passport. Now, you've probably seen this in the press. Now, you know, what is the financial services passport? So it's buried, you know, it's constructed through law. This is where we come in. You know, a huge amount of legislation supports the passport. But essentially the idea is, I'm a bank, I'm an insurance company, I'm a fund manager, I'm a trader, I'm a stock exchange, and whatever I am. Once I am regulated and supervised once, in what we call our home jurisdiction, so for the city, that's the UK, off I go with my passport across borders. So I can trade in securities, I can set up branches, I can service an insurance contract, I can have clients all over Europe, and that is a hugely valuable asset for the financial services sector, because you're cutting away immediately all those transaction costs, and yet you're opening up this massive pool of capital, of liquidity, of risk management opportunities in a pretty, not entirely, but almost legally frictionless environment. So it's very valuable. Now, why on earth, given 2008, would any sane financial regulator allow that to happen? Why would you, as a French regulator, say, come on in, the water's fine, come into my market, we'll have nothing to do with you, I completely trust the UK regulator. Why would that happen? No other economy on earth would tolerate that kind of access. It's because of what the EU passport is based on. Now, the EU passport is based on two things. One, a hugely detailed set of rules, and they're called the single rule book. Now, this single rule book essentially knocks out the UK regulatory system. There isn't one. So EU regulation governs the UK financial market. So you sign up to this huge body of law. The second thing is you sign up to supervisory cooperation. So the UK regulator is very closely connected in to other European regulators. So that's kind of the deal. You get the passport, but you're embedded in this whole system. And that's really where this issue goes live. That you have this enormous market, which is hugely economically important to all of us, to our pensions, our insurance, and everything else, which is economically important, where there is an interdependence between the EU 27 and the UK, but access is constructed around this hugely sophisticated system. And then, as Tony mentioned at the outset, we're in a political context. And the Brexit vote suggests, and I think that's very much a legitimate, you know, interpretation of it, taking back control. And control involves regulatory autonomy and regulatory freedom. So how are those two things going to be squared off? Now, when the UK leaves the EU, it will come outside the single market, you know, as far as current predictions tell us, and it's going to lose the passport. No passport. Now, what happens at a minute past midnight? We don't have anarchy, okay? There are strategies and routes for substituting for the passport. You know, because I'm sure you're all thinking, but these international firms all the way across the EU, they cope. You know, major American banks, major Chinese banks, they're all there. Now, why are they there? Well, the first reason they might be there is they have become EU firms. That's one option. So a UK bank could become an EU bank by just moving over and becoming an EU company. So that's absolutely one route. Downside is London loses that business. They've moved, the risk management is gone, the people is gone, the tax revenue is gone. And from the firm's perspective, it's not straightforward either. Because to move your operations over to the EU, the EU is saying, well, we want your people here, we want your risk management here, we want you following all sorts of rules. So it's doable, but it's not costless. It's not entirely straightforward, but that is one option. The second option is, and Naomi mentioned this earlier, is join the European Economic Area. So Norway, Iceland, Liechtenstein. So they all have the passport. And they're not EU members. But the downside is they're what's called rule takers. So they have to take this huge weight of rules that are coming in, and they can't negotiate them, they can't shape them. Now that leaves us with all this language you're hearing right now. So the option that everybody comes back to then is equivalence. Now what is equivalence? Equivalence is simply the mechanism the EU uses to allow in what are called third countries. The UK, the US, Singapore, Australia. So if you're a third country and you want into the EU, well fine, but you're going to have to follow the equivalence system. Now this is where it starts getting a little bit unattractive. Because the equivalence system, if you boiled it down to its essentials, says you're very welcome, but you've got to follow our rules. And not only do you have to follow our rules, but we will assess how you do supervision. We will assess how you do enforcement. And at any point, we can withdraw the equivalence determination. If your rules start changing, if your supervision starts changing, this is a contingent decision. Now think about it. I'm a major global investment bank. You know, these decisions are huge in terms of how I organize my operations, how I do my risk management, where I put my people. That is not a helpful scenario. So you're telling me, group legal counsel, I'm equivalent now, but who knows when? Sorry, yeah, that's it. That's unstable. And financial markets, above all else, do not like instability, and they don't like a lack of certainty. So there are issues here around regulatory autonomy, around certainty, and around sort of the stability of the relationship with the EU. Now, this is why, really, probably for the last sort of 3 or 4 months or so, we're seeing a lot of language coming out of the UK about a bespoke deal, a special deal, a different deal. Now, why is that even out there? It's because you have two negotiating parties in the financial services space in particular that are kind of locked together. You know, if we don't have proper pipelines, you know, our financial stability is connected to each other, our funding is connected to each other, there's got to be a way, right? We've got to get around this. Now, the city is incredibly good at getting out of tight spots. It's really good at this. It uses derivatives and risk management and arbitrage and off-balance sheets. You know, it's really good at this kind of thing. And that kind of thinking is being used to really great effect in this problem. So the city has been coming up with all sorts of bespoke arrangements whereby, look, it's not equivalence. That just doesn't work. However, we will stay broadly aligned. Our outcomes will be the same. We will supervise in a kind of similar way, but we retain essentially our ability to regulate. And some really big reports have come out of this issue recently on all of this, really quite attractive, sophisticated ways of doing this. The government has recently used this language of ambitious managed divergence, so we might diverge away from the EU rulebook, and we'll do it in this ambitious manner and attract business, but don't worry, we'll all be kind of going in the same direction, so no one need panic. So that's essentially what's going on at the moment. Now the challenge is, will the EU agree to this? Will it not agree to this? The initial mood music is it won't. It's going to say, it's our single market, we're protecting financial stability, you come to our market, you play by our rules, and we're not going to listen to some new way of doing business. It's very hard to call. We'll have to see how it plays out. But one thing I would say is the folk memory of the financial crisis is very, very, very long in the EU. The financial crisis and the euro area crisis was an existential threat. We all know, summer 2010, Mario Draghi We will do everything it takes to protect the euro, and believe me, it will be enough. Now, part of that is the system of rules around it. So we'll see, but that's essentially where the big debate is right now. Now, I'm just going to sort of finish with a kind of an attempt at a prediction, okay? So let's suppose the EU says, no way, ambitious managed divergence. It's equivalence, and we don't like that, and it's bad for the city. How might we end up in sort of 5 years' time? So my prediction would be this, that the city is extraordinarily resilient and highly innovative, and it will figure out ways to get business done in the EU. Even if, remember I said one of the options is become an EU firm, okay? Now, even if that happens on a pretty large scale, I don't see it as being a massive threat to London as a financial centre, because all the indications are that that kind of travel is diverse. So you're getting some to Frankfurt, some to Luxembourg, some to Dublin, some to Brussels, but you're not getting this massive move to another really big centre. So there'll always be this sort of dominance in terms of pulling in all that trading and liquidity. And so far, it doesn't seem that there will be a major competitor. And a related point is, major financial markets are like huge supertankers. You know, they have such huge inbuilt advantages that turning them takes an extraordinarily long time. And who knows, you know, what's going to happen over the next 10 to 15 years in terms of financial markets. To me, actually, the biggest risk would be this one. That, you know, the city will find a way and we'll work it out, but what I would be worried about is that the regulators will come under more political pressure. That there'll be this sense that the city's figuring it out, but really this is proving too complicated. We want deregulation. We want the UK to be a sort of a low-regulation financial environment. And I think that's worrying, because a competition in regulation is not a healthy scenario for any part of the global economy. And I think that risk could be a little bit higher if there isn't a bespoke deal. So with that, I'll leave that.
Great. Well, I think you'll agree two different but complementary views on this subject, one on the broader potential impact on the London and to some extent other UK city economies, and one about this most important tax yielding industry within the UK and indeed Edinburgh and to some extent Leeds economy, finance and financial services. And perhaps I can just begin with a question to you, Naomi. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about any discussion of the impacts, the economic impacts of Brexit, is that you know, there are so many things moving at once. You're trying to, you know, net them all off against each other, and your presentation made that point. But you know, the intriguing risk that Brexit, which might be seen by many people as a sort of cri de coeur by people in left behind regions of the UK, might bring even more of their labour into London. That's, you know, an example of a paradoxical potential consequence. The other is, I noticed the other day that although EU migration is falling, there's been an uptick recently in non-EU migration. And of course, the government doesn't have a migration policy or even a consultation on a migration policy yet. So I suppose my question to you is that how do we imagine the industrial strategy is going to be evolved so that the risk that, in a sense, Brexit accidentally triggers further economic divergence between cities in the north and the Midlands, many of which were areas that voted for Brexit, which had been, you know, it was said left behind. If they were to lose out because of all of this, relatively, possibly absolutely and relatively, what kind of policies can we imagine the government coming up with to try to, given that it's been so difficult to balance the economy already, if this makes it worse, you know, what's the political consequences of that, and how could the government imaginably do anything about it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you tell them now. Now's you've got your chance.
So, I mean, yeah, that's the big risk is that we're going to see, you know, through Brexit and the kind of broader structural changes that are happening taking place in the economy, that we are going to see further divergence between different parts of the UK, with some of our less kind of economically buoyant places seeing lower levels of growth compared to places like London. I think what's interesting in the industrial strategy is that there are kind of five pillars. It's looking at things like skills, business support, infrastructure, innovation, and how we essentially might use economic development policy to help to support new activity and new economic growth across the UK. And we're doing some work at the moment thinking through what the industrial strategy means for cities and for places, and what local industrial strategies need to look at. I think fundamental to trying to support the kind of longer term sustainable growth of our cities and all parts of the UK economy is our investment in skills and education. So I think that is absolutely fundamental to ensuring that individuals and businesses are able to adapt and respond to some of the big changes that will be brought about by Brexit, and some of the bigger changes, the bigger kind of structural changes, like the impacts of kind of automation and demographic change, which will all have an impact on our economy and the jobs that people will be doing. So I think at the heart of the industrial strategy and local industrial strategies has to be investment in skills and education. But we also need to be thinking, across policy areas and thinking about how different policy areas interact. How investment in infrastructure can help businesses to access the skills and workers that they need going forward, and how we might use business and kind of innovation policy to support businesses in all parts of the UK to innovate and become more productive.
And of course there are, even today, I mean, London still has relatively low employment rates and relatively high unemployment rates, despite the massive success of its economy. So there is still room, even in London, to expand the labour market and bring more people into it. Niamh, there's one for you before I open this out. I mean, the one country that strikes me, particularly given what you were saying about financial services and the service-based economy, with which where you can see a sort of glimmer of, well, not so much hope as a kind of, a European country which manages all of this outside the EU, is Switzerland, isn't it? Now, Switzerland has bespoke deals, really, doesn't it? It's all bespoke. I recently heard an event here where a senior Swiss official used the fascinating, going back to the lexicon of language that we all now so like, the concept, and it said something like, the Swiss government spends a lot of time autonomously accepting into Swiss law, EU law. So I thought it was a masterpiece. Ambitious managed divergence is another classic. I'm saving these. Anyway, the point is this. Does Switzerland, which is a service-based economy, a European country, a rich country with a very powerful currency, why is it that Britain couldn't do that or something? If the EU agreed to it, obviously.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tony. And it kind of makes me laugh in a way, because it brings in mind sort of how my work has changed in the last year. I knew almost nothing about how Switzerland goes about its financial regulation business. But of course, when this happens, you're going, who does this? Who has figured out a way to do this? And famously, there is this, it's only in insurance, but there is an insurance trade agreement between Switzerland and the EU. So battalions of academics and city lawyers descended on this agreement that no one had ever looked at before to figure out, this is the answer. Now, exactly as you say, the problem is, the answer is, yes, you can be a Swiss firm and access the EU, but you've got to do everything that we ask you to do. And that's kind of the way the insurance system works. Now, the slightly troubling thing, and it's a great question, Tony, because it opens up another issue. It's sort of the direction of travel of the EU. So in my little world, a hugely exciting event happened very close to Christmas, actually, in that the Commission, remember I talked about equivalence, the Commission makes these equivalence decisions, it can change its mind, and so on and so on. Well, Switzerland had been autonomously accepting a huge bunch of rules around stock exchanges. They've been doing this, the poor guys have been at this for about 4 years, trying to move their rules on stock exchanges so they would be equivalent with the EU. And they thought they were pretty much there. And then just before Christmas came the nice present from the Commission. Yes, we've looked at your rules and that they're all fine. So we're giving you equivalence for 1 year. Now, if you're a stock exchange, that just forget it. I mean, how on earth are you going to plan your trading platforms and your risk management and all the rest of it for 1 year? Some contracts, some derivatives, the life of the derivative will go way longer than a year. And why did the EU do that? There was a wider political consideration. The EU is getting increasingly uncomfortable with these sort of bespoke Swiss arrangements, and it wants to lock them into a more secure institutional structure. You know, it wants a kind of migration to be tied to their arrangements with Switzerland. It wants a more formal kind of dispute resolution mechanism. It wants the Commission to be kind of more centrally engaged. So that gave everybody a bit of a cold chill at Christmas, because there was always this idea, Switzerland does it, the President is out there, but there seems to be some sense that the EU is pulling back.
Okay, of course, you see that the Brexit vote and that could be linked in some way. All right, enough from me now. I'll take two or three questions, or if you want to make very short remarks. And if you want to direct them at one or other of the panellists, do, otherwise I will choose on your behalf. And right, one, two, three all together here.
Good evening. Thank you for the presentations. Were quite interesting.
If you want to say who you are, I don't feel you've got to, but if you want to say who you are, do say who you are.
My name is Anna. I'm not a student of LSE. I did study in London, and I'm now working in London for more than a couple of years. So it's interesting for me to understand how my life was a bit, my expectations were a bit different when I actually moved to London, and things are now changing a little bit. But anyway, as we're now talking about Switzerland, maybe this might be more directed to Professor Niem. What do you think is the role of Norway when Norway is starting to now say, well, but if you're going to give a better deal to the UK, then we're going to pull out? Because the market, well, in broad sense, the market of Norway is not as big as the market of the UK, but would that actually have, do you think that would actually have a weight in the negotiations and how you're not playing out?
And I'll take the next two as well, two behind you, and then we'll...
Hi, my name is Jacob. I'm a LLM student at LSE. Also a question for Professor Maloney, because you sketched the impact of Brexit on London in terms of its financial center, but what's the impact of this on the rest of the European Union?
Okay.
Hello, I'm Frido, also an LLM student here. Thank you for your contributions. I think I'd like to add to the point my neighbour made. We've obviously talked about the influence of the Brexit on the London city, but we've, to my surprise really, we've seen from Brussels that they don't really seem to be very concerned about an impact on cross-border financial services, and that kind of surprised me, because in a large extent, the city is still the banker of the EU and of the EU economy. From what I've seen, we can't really do without the city still. So indeed, to what way is Brussels maybe pretending not to be fearful, but they are, and does that still have an impact on the potential outcome of the Brexit deal? So whereas they've sort of closed the door on a lot of favorable deals for the city, might there be down the road a possibility that they come back on that standpoint? Thank you in advance.
I suppose just I can add to that. So all these three arrangements. I suppose the addition to that is that it's very hard for an outsider, i.e. any of us, to know what's a bargaining position and what's the deep private position on both sides. I mean, insofar as they know than I know, that's not a matter of
course. Well, absolutely.
So, Britain.
So thanks so much. They're super questions. So in terms of sort of the Norway position, I mean, I think there's sort of a macro issue about if the UK gets a special deal, we're going to want a special deal. So we're coming out of the EEA. I'm not sure that's where Norway is. I mean, so from kind of just conversations I've had, there is a sense that as an economy, they have become accustomed to this sort of rule-taking status. They have figured out ways of managing it. They have various parliamentary committees and tricks and kind of ways of doing things. So they've kind of figured out how you do the rule-taking. And I think the systems for kind of making the single market run are kind of established. So while there might be a rhetoric around that, it's hard to see it translating into, well, if you give them that, we want this or we're off. I think another interesting thing about the EEA, though, is, I mean, one of the arguments that was made around about the time of the referendum was, well, let's go into the EEA. Now, if you talk to people in the EEA, they were less comfortable about that. Because if you think about it, you're putting in place a massive economy. I mean, in terms of the relationships, you'd be putting in a massive power broker in a small group of countries. So I think myself the EEA ship has slightly sailed, but what I would keep an eye on is in a 5, 10, 15 year time frame. You have the UK as a major offshore economy, you have the EEA. I would watch that one for developing in an interesting way, because it has a sort of a set of structures, and one might see it developing in a very different manner with the UK. And possibly Switzerland, indeed. We'll see how it plays out. And secondly, now, both those questions are super ones, and they're ones that, you know, I'm constantly thinking about. So, Jake, if I go to you first, in terms of the impact on the EU, I think there's two. The first one is, the UK always had a kind of a friction. It was sort of the bump in the road, if you like. And it was the bump in the road that kind of slowed down integration. You know, it was sort of, we don't want the big push to the centre, we don't really like banking union, we're suspicious about the euro area, the single market is different to the euro area. You know, David Cameron's new settlement, that big agreement just before the referendum, that was all about the single market is different. The EU is a multi-currency zone. And that has, you know, a lot of implications for how you design what the EU looks like. Now, take out that friction, which is going to happen, and I think the euro area will really start flexing its muscles in terms of what the EU looks like. Part of that, of course, is President Macron. You know, there is a change in political atmosphere right now. So that's one. I think we're going to see more centralisation and beefing up of the European Central Bank. Well, it's just, you know, it could take 5 years, but I would very much see that. Now, Friso, both of you coming together then in terms of the financial impact and kind of the negotiating ship. I think you're right, okay? So the fundraising pipeline, the risk management pipeline from the UK to the EU is huge. Now, probably the single big issue, and some of you may come across this phrase, CCPs, you know. So CCP is a central clearing party, a kind of a nuclear power plant that does really scary things with derivatives, but it's really important. If they go down, we all go home. Okay, the 2008, forget it, this is the end of the world, okay? Now, most of this activity is in the UK. And that is a huge, huge issue for the EU. But what's interesting, Friso and Jakob, if you look at sort of how the EU has reacted to this issue so far, it's trying to relocate it by force, if you like. So by law, it's saying, if you want to do business in the EU, you have to move to the EU. So there's that sort of sense that we recognise the risk, but we're going to just kind of force it back. Two other really quick points. The second one is, the UK is really important from a markets perspective. But yet, a lot of the EU financial system is bank-based. So I just wonder if this will be sort of a return to a bank-based, quieter, less sort of Anglo-American, noisy kind of capitalism. So that's the second thing. And a third thing is, one of the points that was kind of just mentioned briefly earlier, in terms of the bargaining chips, just never underestimate how close to the bone the financial crisis goes in the EU. And that sense that the euro area almost broke up. So my prediction would be possibly a special deal on something that's really important for the EU. If they decide asset management, we're going to wall on, you might find this. But I would be surprised if it's a wider deal because of these wider issues.
Nick, can I just ask, I mean, extend this question to you in a slightly different way. I mean, your charts and the data show that not just London, as you know, it's Edinburgh for sure, I did Leeds, but the truth is many other cities in the UK particularly with Cardiff and Belfast, big sort of capital cities, all have elements of this kind of economy and would like to have bigger ones. I mean, they wanted more of this. So the truth is that this sort of service-based advanced economy, which, you know, lots of European countries are good with, many British cities are very good at, so the cities themselves, including those, not just London, are going to be lobbying. I'm intrigued to see that the leaders of Leeds, Newcastle and other core cities were in Brussels, Mr. Barnier, the other day, on the TV as well. So, in a sense, it's a London issue, but it's actually another cities in Britain issue and a UK Treasury issue, isn't it, getting this stuff right, the city and financial services right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, if you look at where the UK's kind of comparative advantage increasingly lies, it's in knowledge-based services. It's in the financial and business service sectors. So getting the deal right, it doesn't just matter for London, it matters for cities across the UK.
Great. Okay. Right. Now, more hands. I wish to see. I see one hand there, and one at the back there, and one here. So, yep. I think there's a microphone heading your way. And then the back. Let's put on that again.
Hi there. Just in the name of practicing empathy for Brexiteers. I'm conscious that they would argue that yes, we're going to have a period of difficulty whilst we're sorting out what we do with the EU. But in the long term, it's other parts of the world which are on the rise. It's what we refer to as the West that's in decline. So therefore, all of this is short-term pain for long-term gain. So I was just wondering if you could give your thoughts on what those possible scenarios might be in the long term.
Okay. Good question, and we don't have a view on Brexit at the LSE. The audience can have a view, we don't. We have a balanced and neutral at the end. Right, now, they're right back there, yeah, and then further forward here. Right, back, wait. Oh, I'm sorry. We're really hair shirt easy on the microphone, isn't it? Well, the first three questions didn't tell me that, did they?
Hello, and thank you for the great talk. I am not a student. I work in the construction industry, and usually that is the first industry to get hit by economic difficulties. I would like to ask the worst and best case scenario what London might look like in 10 years. Thank you.
Right, okay. Well, that's okay, and is it worst or best, did you say? Or did you just say worst?
Worst and best,
you did. That's good, that's good. Keep, right. And then there's a questioner here.
Hi, thank you very much to both of you. Talking about ambitious managed divergence and all that bonfire of regulatory red tape we've heard about, I work currently in the post-trade area, and we don't see, and from where we hear finance, we don't see so many regulations that people in finance would like to get rid of. At the same time, we've seen that Bank of England has a tendency to gold plate regulations rather to try to undermine them. So are there really other areas, both finance and other sectors, where there is really a demand for less or divergent regulation? Is that really something that the UK needs or wants, except for a few politicians?
Okay. Let's go to you first. On the period of difficulty, but potential for long-term gain. In fairness, your research did address that question, though it actually sort of came to the conclusion that the long-term gain might be better in the places with the sort of postmodern economies than in the places which were more traditional, I think I'm right in saying. But anyway, what about the period of sort of difficulty followed by the potential for long-term gain, and then the 10 years out question?
Mm. So the model that CEP developed was looking at the medium run impacts, so looking at kind of 10 years into the future. And, you know, it shows, as I said, that there is likely to be a loss of GVA. And you know, other studies that factor in some of the more kind of dynamic effects and kind of broader effects in terms of migration and foreign direct investment show that in terms of kind of soft Brexit, you're looking at around a 0.8% loss of GVA in London compared to around 1.9% if we had a hard Brexit scenario. So, you know, even when you start to factor in how London might respond and kind of broader impacts, the kind of further you get away from the status quo, the larger the negative impact.
That's a modelled impact based on the world we know now. But I suppose, you know, the question about the future was trying to pick up on the idea that if we all believe in it and we all actively work for it, then Britain could benefit from a looser trading relationship with the EU, but a new one with countries whose economies are growing far faster than the, you know, slow-moving European bloc. But without putting words in your mouth, I think that would require quite a big change, though, in the way cities themselves undertook the things they do, wouldn't it? They'd have to change.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, at present, the EU market, you know, accounts for more than half of exports for UK cities, and just under half in London. So it would require a big change in terms of where cities and businesses are trading with. Of course, you know, all of these models are based on assumptions and predictions. But yeah, it would require a big change in the current state.
Great, okay. Neve, Bank of England gold plating London in 10 years, best and worst?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. So the kind of other opportunities, rest of the world, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. So so the city's connection back to the EU in 2007 is in around 25% of what happens in the city. So a lot of it is entirely international. And certainly the city has had a really good track record as a regulated space in being welcoming to, you know, actors from outside the EU bloc. The regulator, the FCA, has a competitiveness mandate, so that is very much key to what they do. And I just draw your attention to just before Christmas, the Bank of England and the FCA produced their policies on how they were going to engage with, essentially, if you like, the EU becomes a third country, becomes sort of, you know, something different on withdrawal, and very accommodating, very facilitative. The demands for funding in developing parts of the world are enormous, and right now London has the huge pools of capital, so absolutely that is going to be a key part of the city's future. Secondly, the gold plating, yeah, this is a really good point, because so much of the issue here about equivalence, managed divergence, it kind of presupposes there's a huge kind of pent-up demand to get rid of everything, and I agree, I do not think there is. Now, one of the reasons for that is financial firms might lobby very aggressively and, you know, I mean assertively rather, they might put their position very strongly about regulation, but the costs are sunk. You know, once you are signed up to a system, they won't want to change it. So, for example, this enormous rule came in January called MiFID II. MiFID II is like this is a monstrous thing. But once you've got your systems in order and your IT is in place, that's where you want to be. Okay, so that's one thing. I don't think there'll be industry pushback for that. Where you might see the deregulation push is sort of around the edges. So something like bankers' bonuses. But the trouble is, if the UK government went to deregulate bankers' bonuses, that's not going to play well with the electorate. So I agree. I'm not so convinced there is a big kind of pent-up demand for deregulation. And I think, going to your point earlier, Tony, and somebody over there, the bargaining chip, that could well be part of this. Look, you know, we don't really need to deregulate. Let's talk, okay? Can we just figure out a way through this? And thirdly, London in 10 years' time, we'll all be here, for sure, you know, teaching wonderful students and doing what we do. I think London will have really increased its links with the rest of the world. I think there'll be very, very strong flows of capital from Southeast Asia, from the African continent, from South America. Some big links are coming through from Chile and Mexico in terms of funding requirements. And one of the reasons I say that is, you know, the world is becoming more interconnected all the time in terms of capital. Regulators are talking to each other more. The international standard setters, the Basel Committee, people like that who set global rules, are talking to each other more. And here's the thing. So, you know, you're all young and kind of innovative and whizzy and all the rest of it. Now, I bet you do your banking through your mobile phone. I don't. I go to my bank. Okay, but what I'm saying is that the world of finance is going to look very different in 10, 20 years' time. You know, it could be Apple, it could be Facebook, it could be, who knows, somebody that's not yet out there providing financial services. So what we think about financial services is going to be a very different space. So the UK could have a really big fintech digitalization space there to come up with very new ways of doing business, because we're all working off, you know, Tony mentioned the current status quo. That's what we're working off. Big banks doing things we understand. That may be completely different in 10 years' time.
May one person who hasn't got a mention yet tonight, but let's go for it, is Donald Trump. Donald Trump, it's unusual in an event like this. Donald Trump is, I think I've heard, beginning to move to liberalise Wall Street somewhat. And, you know, was always a part of the New York world rather than, you know, rural hinterland of the United States, between the coasts. So, I mean, his moves in that direction could be more influential on all of this than the EU or Britain, couldn't it?
I think that's right. It'll be a really interesting one, because this would be the kind of the global acid test for something we all, it's kind of one of the assumptions the policymakers, regulators, the industry uses, which is that everybody wants high standards. But everybody has had high standards since 2008. So this will be a bit of a crunch in terms of, if you do get deregulation in the US, will people go, ooh, not sure about that, a bit risky, you know, would rather be somewhere else, thank you. Or will it start the pressure to deregulate?
I'm just going to add from the chair a thought on the 10 years time question. What one thing that I personally think is almost inevitably the case is that, before Britain joined the EU, and for the big increase in the number of states in the EU, a relatively larger proportion of migration from outside the world came to London than to the rest of the country. So the EU produced different kinds of migrants who are much more visible in the rest of the UK than the earlier groups of migrants were, who tended to stay in cities more. If we're going to have fewer EU migrants, and I mentioned the uptick in non-EU migration, I think London will then start to get a bigger share of those migrants again. So London will have the, in my personal view, I'm going to express a view here, the advantage of more migration. My worry for the rest of the country is if they lose the dynamism that comes with migration, that would be not helpful to their economies. And I think and it also risks further separateness between London and the rest of the UK. But that's, you know, meeting, as ever, Cassandra. Right, more questions. One right at the back there. I put three again. We've got two more. One here, at the far end, or right as far away as possible. Okay, let's take two. And a third hand could go up. It would be nice. Okay. Yes, go for it. Sorry, I'm putting the wrong place. It's not your fault.
Okay. Hi, my name is Albin, and I work for one of those five companies that predominantly do business outside of UK. But my question is not related to that. My question is related to, we heard a lot about migration, GDP changes, effects of Brexit, but what I didn't hear, and I'm very curious to hear your opinion, is like, how will it affect property prices in London, because we might own some properties here and we might be worried that the mortgage that we have on it is not going to cover the costs and so on. And also, how will it affect interest rates? So will we be able to afford them? Maybe best case, worst case scenario in that. So if that could be good. Thank you.
Okay. And right down the front here, I'm afraid. Carriers of the torch, is it right? A third question? Oh, third question, somebody here asked me a question nearby. No?
Yeah, a simple question. If the Conservative government falls apart for whatever reason and Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister, what impacts do the panel think that might have?
Donald Trump and Jeremy Corbyn are now on stage. Is he good? All right. Well, interesting, I meant. I meant good in a kind of it's interesting for the conversation way rather than any political comment. Right. I think... Sorry. In light. Okay. It's an omen. Naomi, do you want to have a go on property prices and interest rates?
On property prices, I mean, we've seen that transactions in London have slowed quite significantly. And there's an interesting trend, you know, in some of the most recent data where house price growth has started to fall, particularly in kind of more central parts of London. And you're not seeing that in some of the outer skirts of London. So things are starting to change. I'm not entirely sure what will happen with interest rates, but clearly that will have an impact as well. Interesting question about Jeremy Corbyn and the approach that a Labour led government might take. Clearly there's been debate about kind of the customs union and the kind of proposals being put forward. There, I think there are interesting debates too about the whole devolution agenda and the direction of travel that might take under a Labour government. Because clearly, since 2010, with David Cameron and George Osborne, there has been quite considerable movement in terms of devolution to London and other cities with the establishment of the Metro Mayors and Combined Authorities, and that's certainly something that we're very much behind in terms of giving cities more autonomy and control. So it'd be interesting to see how that agenda would play out too.
Great. Okay, Neil.
Yeah, so maybe I'll go with Jeremy Corbyn. So, great question. The first thing is, so the customs union debate, which I guess we're all following as of yesterday, Monday, that won't affect financial services. So the customs union has nothing to do with services and financial services, so we don't get anywhere with that. The second thing is, the Labour Party has been more accommodating on transition. So it has been a little bit more flexible about over the transition period, the UK kind of signing up to EU structure. So if it happened really immediately, I think it would be easier to get a transition deal and possibly for longer. The third thing is, though, you know, I don't know, but you could get a fairly cold wind blowing through in terms of financial regulation. So what I've just been saying about kind of the status quo, openness, competitiveness, that could change. You know, it could be a sense that a Labour government might be a bit less accommodating of capital coming in externally, of potentially, for example, stability risks at the Bank of England might have to step behind, more pressure on deposit protection. So it's a great question because there's quite a few pieces that would move around together.
Do you have a few of it? I don't want to put you on the spot. Do you have a view yourself?
Not really, no. Okay. It'd be fascinating to another... throw into the pot, yeah.
Right, now we've got time for one further round of questions, so in order to stop me asking, somebody else should really. Would somebody like to? Yeah, good.
Hi.
We'll wait for the microphone, which is near. Thank you. Oh, goodness.
Okay. Hi, I'm Sarah, EU citizen living in London. From my perspective, and obviously following the referendum and vote itself, it was, for me, there was a lot of kind of social economic element to it and how people voted and where they were based and how they voted. Obviously thinking about North versus the South and maybe London versus other kind of regions in the UK, do you think that the UK government will forget about this and just focus its trade deal on saving, you know, the revenue hub that London is at the moment?
Okay, very good. And someone nearby? Yes. Something there. Very good.
Anybody else who puts their hand up is 100% guaranteed to have a kind of answer. So, yeah, well done, it worked. Yes, go on.
Hi, my name's Elliot. I work for a public affairs consultancy. I just wanted to ask, on migration and the different impacts between London and maybe the rest of the country, from what we know of the government's policy, it seems to be that they would set some sort of bar in terms of recruiting skilled migration from overseas, which would probably be good for sort of a services-based economy like London, like you described London, but it seems that a lot of what is actually will be needed is things like what I suppose we refer to as non-skilled migration, agricultural labour, etc., which would probably, do you think that would have a detrimental impact on the rest of the country and create a sort of extend the divide between London and rural economies?
Okay, another great one. And one final at the back there, same gentleman as before, but I said he could have one if he needed, and he did.
Another big question. Second referendum, what's your opinion? Is it a possibility or not? And if it is, will it be different?
Right. Well, that's about seven different impossible to answer questions tangled in one. So well done. Good one to end on, too. Right.
The question about the second referendum, that's a really difficult one to answer. I'll leave that to her, please. really interesting questions. I think certainly the referendum vote highlighted the kind of socio-economic challenges that exist, that have long existed across the country. And whilst I think lots of politicians and policymakers were aware of it, I think it's kind of pushed kind of inclusive growth up the agenda. And certainly in terms of thinking through how government and places respond to that, you know, there's a lot of work going into, you know, how do we support you know, economic growth that is at the same time inclusive and delivers better outcomes for communities and individuals. And I think that's an important question in terms of the industrial strategy, you know, being a lot of emphasis on how through those investments you can support new activity and economic growth, but at the same time drive up levels of productivity in some of our big kind of low productivity sectors and improve employment opportunities for people who are in kind of some of those lower skilled, lower wage jobs. And, you know, I don't think there are any kind of easy answers there, but it's certainly kind of a challenge that, you know, national politicians and local level government are grappling with. The extent to which that kind of, you know, dies down with the kind of different policy cycles, I hope it doesn't. On other skilled migration, I think it's a really interesting question thinking about kind of future migration policy. When you look at you know, city economies across the UK and the composition of kind of workforce across our urban labour markets, you can see that in terms of kind of reliance on European and international labour, it really does look quite different according to the kind of, you know, industrial and occupational kind of makeup of different urban economies. So I think that really that kind of variation does need to be factored into those national level kind of negotiations and policy changes, because you know, what's decided at the national level will have quite different impacts across the country.
Very good. Okay. Niamh.
Okay, so as a lawyer, let me give you just sort of a reaction to the socioeconomic one. This is purely as a, some, you know, with a sense of sort of constitutional dynamics. One thing that's been very obvious since June 2016 is just the prominence of the devolved units. They're politically prominent in a way they haven't been for a long time. So, Scotland, of course, is a distinct situation. So I think that suggests it will be much harder for central government to not deal with this issue, because there's a sort of an energy and an ambition and a confidence, I think, right now about the devolved units. So I'll give the second referendum a go, okay? So I think, first of all, you can tell I'm Irish, okay? Well, maybe. Well, I'm Irish, okay? So you see, if it was Ireland, say, no problem, you know? So we have a decision, and people don't like it or do like it or whatever, but it comes back, you know, in 2 years' time. So we have done this frequently, usually if we've been given more money or more information. So, you know, but that's the serious point I would make there is that referenda in Ireland and indeed in Switzerland are not that unusual. They're something the population kind of moans about and complains about, but they kind of get out and do them, and there's a familiarity with them. The UK is a parliamentary democracy. It works through Parliament. A referendum was a really different and unusual and special thing for the UK to engage in. So because of that, I think it has a kind of a special status in terms of its outcome. So it would take a lot, I think, an awful lot, for that sort of direct voice to be moved in some way. So I think for it to happen, so what do I think? I think for this to be even on the table in any way, there would have to be an extraordinarily different set of circumstances. So really something very, very big. And my instinct is, we're really not going to know how all this is going to play out for quite a while. We're not going to know in 3 years' time or 4 years' time. So that's one thing. And I think the second thing is, to the extent this decision gets replayed or we get re-asked, my instinct is it would be through a general election, that it would be, if a government fell over the next while, that the mandate politicians would go on would be, not that we don't follow the referendum, but we're going for EEA, we're going for customs union, we're going for soft Brexit, or we're not. I think that's more likely to be the context in which the big issue of our day might be reopened again.
Great. Okay, well, before I thank both our speakers for their excellent contributions and also elegantly answering the questions, I just want to say perhaps two or three words of my own, or even more of my own. Just to conclude, first, given that Niamh pointed out she comes from the island of Ireland, what intrigues me about all of this is that the pressures to deliver the open, frictionless, perfect and wonderful border between Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which, in fairness to them, the Democratic Unionist Party are as interested in as doing as anybody else. If it's sorted out, then everything's sorted out. That's the first thing which intrigues me about this, because if it can be made to work between Ireland and Northern Ireland, whatever it is, will work between the United Kingdom and everywhere else because of the DUP. A fascinating curiosity. Second, the point about rebalancing and what else the vote meant, seems to me that the vote, because it was a binary choice, A versus B, and A could include anything, and B could include anything, other than the one simple thing, which is leaving the EU, then if people wanted rebalancing of the UK economy or some areas to do better than they have in the past, which they may have done, it wasn't on the face of the referendum. So it's easier not to do it than it would be not to leave the EU. And that, I think, this is going to haunt British politics for some time to come, whatever happens with Brexit. Third, on the migration point, I mean, it's interesting, I think it may have been the day after the referendum, the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, you know, started his London is Open campaign, which they've kept going ever since. And I do think that, you know, if you listen to the debate about what other parts of the country, which voted strongly to leave the EU, most famous in rural areas, now, of course, want their own migration. They do want agricultural workers. And I've heard the leader of Cornwall Council saying Cornwall needs its own bespoke migration policy and so on. So the government's got to balance this off as well. Because on the one hand, people may have been saying something about migration in the Brexit vote, though in London they said the opposite. But the government's got to get this right for the economy as well, and not just the London economy. And again, if they get it right for Lincolnshire, it'll probably be all right for London. So that they've got to do all of that as well. Third, on the ambiguity of language. I mean, what intrigues me about this, and you know, there are books to be written about this, is the way language is used now. It tells us something about the way politics and deal making works that I didn't know before, which is the constructive ambiguity, to use David Davis's words, allow Mrs. May to keep everybody on side until a decision is made, and that's why it's hard to make a decision. And as we know, British governments find it hard to make decisions. Look at the runway in the southeast. The question of how far this can go on before a decision is made is the most interesting in contemporary politics, it seems to me. And then last for me, about the second referendum. I don't think there'll be a second referendum personally. I think politicians of all parties are a bit uneasy about referenda these days. It might, by the way, whichever side you're on, it might come out, in fact, if you look at the polling, it can come out with the same result, more likely than not. But I do think what's intriguing to me is that, in a sense, we've got a struggle now going on between Parliament and the Crown, a bit like the English Civil War, really. Parliament, where the majority of MPs and the majority of members of the Lords want to stay in the EU, or at least stay as close to it as possible, and the government, representing the EU referendum to leave vote, trying to find a way of delivering that while keeping a very powerful group of its own MPs on side. And I mean, if you think forward from that, the most likely outcome is that we do leave the EU, but with something nearer to Switzerland than Canada plus, or you know, whatever. But again, who knows? And frankly, most of my political predictions are wrong on anything. So whatever else has been said tonight, don't listen to me. Anyway, thank you for coming, especially given that you know we've been warned for days that none of us will be able to get in or out of our homes because of the weather. So thank you for coming. It's been a fun evening, I think.